In his best-selling book, Knowing God, the Anglican theologian Dr. J.I. Packer, in an early chapter, deals with the second commandment, which, traditionally speaking, says, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." And he talks about one of the weaknesses of having images or representations of God or of Christ. And what it all comes down to from his perspective is this, that when we have a particular picture in our minds of God or of Jesus, we tend to choose the image that we prefer, and as a result, inadvertently, close ourselves off to other images of Jesus or of God. So, for example, we might say, and it wouldn't be a surprise in this particular parish, for us to say that we like to think of Jesus as the Good Shepherd. And then what often comes to mind is that picture of Jesus tenderly holding a lamb in his arms. And we might be very inspired by that image, and that image is true, and that image is right, because that's part of who Jesus is. But Jesus is also a returning king. Jesus is also the one who God has given all judgment to. We might say we like to think of God as the great architect as we look around at all of creation. But we have to understand that God is also the jealous God that he talks about in the Old Testament. When we have these preferred images, we sometimes miss the fact that there are a multiplicity of facets of the character and nature of God and of Christ that we must be careful not to miss. And I think it's because of these things that sometimes the letters to the churches in Revelation chapter 2 and 3 are often forgotten about, because the image of Jesus that we get in these letters tends to go beyond the good shepherd or the tender, loving one, the one who always has his arms wide open. It looks a little different. And you might notice in the past number of weeks as we've been going through this series that each of these letters follows a particular pattern, and there is an aspect of that pattern we've tended to overlook each Sunday, mainly for the interests of time. But let me just bring that part up today. Every letter begins with a description of Jesus, the one who is doing the talking. And the image that is given is drawn from the original vision that John had in Revelation chapter 1. You might recall that John saw one like a son of man walking among seven golden lampstands. He had hair that was white like wool and eyes with blazing fire and a golden sash and feet like burnished bronze. And it was understood that, of course, that this is Jesus now saying to John, "I want you to write down what it is that you see and write it to these seven churches." And then in chapter 2, he begins to give specific letters for each of these specific churches. And so each church has an aspect of this vision of Jesus starting off the letter, because it ties in with what is to follow. So for example, just by way of reminder, and for those of you who've been reading Revelation chapter 1 and 2 and 3 just to stay on top of things, this will be quite familiar to you. But if we go back to the very first of the seven letters, it was to the church in Ephesus. And it says this, "These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands." And we learned from Revelation chapter 1 that the seven stars represent the seven angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches themselves. So the one who is speaking to Ephesus is the one who holds the foundation of the Spirit, the life of the churches themselves, and is indeed among the churches. And what he has to say to Ephesus is this, "You've forsaken your first love. I, the one who holds the heart of your church, you have let your hearts depart from me." And so this aspect of who Jesus is becomes the source of the correction that Ephesus needs to hear. The next letter is for the church in Smyrna. "These are the words of the first and the last, who was dead and who came to life." Smyrna is the church that Jesus has to say, "I see that you've been enduring faithfully through persecution. It's going to get worse. You need to remain faithful, faithful even to death." But he begins the letter by saying, "I'm the one who died, but now came to life. I'm the one who has conquered death, so there's no need for you to have to fear that kind of endurance." To the church in Pergamum, "These are the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword." And this is a sword that was coming out of his mouth in the vision. And what Pergamum had to deal with was Jesus was saying, you guys are tolerating the teachings of Balaam, which encouraged people to be idolaters, and you're also tolerating the teaching of the Nicolaitans. That has to change. And Jesus identifies that the way that that teaching is changed is by the word of God, the word of Christ, what it is that Jesus has to say, and his words become like a sword that cut through all of the stuff that doesn't belong to reveal that which is the proclamation of the gospel. Last week, we looked at Thyatira. These are the words of the Son of God who has eyes like a flame of fire. This was perhaps the most challenging of the letters that we have read because Jesus doesn't have anything good to say about Thyatira. And they were ones who were making room for this so-called prophetess who was given the metaphoric name of Jezebel, who was infiltrating the church and inducing the church to do all sorts of things that ought not to be. And the one who has eyes like fire, who can see into what's going on here, is encouraging the church at Thyatira to deal with this teaching that doesn't belong. And so today, we are now in Philadelphia. And the church in Philadelphia is addressed by this one. These are the words of the Holy One, the true one, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. There's a few descriptions of Jesus in here. One of them we're very familiar with, the Holy One. Something that is holy is set apart. It is unlike anything else. Jesus is identified as the Holy One, and that's something we hear. We hear it in our prayers. Whether we're talking about some of our collects or our intercessions, we often hear the phrase Holy One referring to Jesus, referring to God, and that's great. But the next one is also referring to Jesus, the True One. And that one we tend not to use so much. And it might be interesting to figure out why that might be. And I think one suggestion might be that if we are to imply that Jesus is the True One, then it implies that there are others who are not. And that can sound a little over the top to some, or perhaps a little not politically correct or something like that. But nevertheless, this is how Jesus is revealed as the true one. He did say, I am the way and the truth and the life. And so for Philadelphia to hear that these words are being spoken by the true one, the idea is they can understand that what is being said to them can be counted on, can be held fast to. And so now, as the one who holds the key of David, who opens and no one can shut, who shuts and no one can open, they are going to hear from the one who is providing for them something that they will take hold of. So here's what Jesus says. I know your works. Look, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Jesus sets before them an open door which no one can shut. Jesus has nothing bad to say to the church of Philadelphia, by the way. He doesn't have to say, I have this against you. Here's something you have to fix up. It's just all good, just like the church in Smyrna. And so this promise to set before them an open door gets us going thinking, what is this open door all about? But before we get into that, one other thing to draw attention to. We have been talking about each of these churches and talking a bit about the city in which they're located and what their circumstance is, what's happening in the geography around them or the character of each city. And so with Philadelphia, we have another interesting scenario because Jesus' response to the church has a connection with what they're facing in their particular cities as well. Philadelphia is inland from the western coast of Asia Minor, and what makes it rather unique is it had become a fortress city. And the reason for that is there were three or four ancient roads from the coast that found their terminus at Philadelphia, and then there was a single road that headed east into the heart of Asia Minor, into the center of the interior of Turkey. And so Philadelphia became a gateway city. That was how you got into the heart of the territory. And so it was developed as a fortress because if you want to protect the inside of the country, you need to make sure that nobody can get past this place. So Philadelphia was the gatekeeper of the interior of the country. It was also prosperous. It had a good textile and leather working industry. And it also, I love this one, was well known for the vineyards around it. So wine from Philadelphia was well known in the region, so maybe that's why several roads were going to Philadelphia. Anyway, having said that, Nevertheless, the church is now part of this city. And Jesus acknowledges that it is weak. It is not as strong as other things that are happening around it. But nevertheless, they're persevering and staying faithful despite whatever challenges they're facing. And so Jesus says to them, I am setting before you an open door. Just as Philadelphia was the door to the interior of Turkey, so also the church in Philadelphia has before them an open door. Now, what is that open door for? There are a couple of ideas about that. One of them might be an affirmation that the church in Philadelphia will receive all of the blessings of all that is promised for Christ at his second coming. He says later in the letter that he is coming back, he is coming soon. But it would seem kind of strange that that would be said specifically to Philadelphia when that is indeed the heritage of all who have faith in Christ. So the other option might well be that this is an open door of opportunity for sharing the gospel, for evangelization, for telling people the good news about Jesus Christ and talking about what it is that Christ has done. And it seems that that might well be the case, because as they were located in what will become the access point to the heart of the country, it turns out over the course of history that the church in Philadelphia is the one that remained the strongest of these seven churches as we saw the rising of Islam and the Islam caliphate in the area. I mean, Turkey today isn't a Muslim nation, right? And so Islam emerged in 600 AD, and over the years that followed, the caliphate grew in the Middle East and made its way across northern Africa and then up into Spain. And even today, you can see that a number of city names in Spain have an Arabic root. And through all of this expansion, the church in Philadelphia remained quite strong up until 1392 AD, before it was finally subsumed. And today, there are still Christians in Turkey, but life is far more difficult for them simply because it's a Muslim nation. It seems that Philadelphia took advantage of this open door, that they followed through on being faithful and carried on and held out the light of Christ. And so we look back to the letter and see what else Jesus has to say to them. He says, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but are lying, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Jesus said similar words to the church in Smyrna, because the church in Smyrna was also dealing with this synagogue of Satan. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I had mentioned that this is not an anti-Semitic statement. This is not an anti-Jewish statement that some Christians are making about the Jews. That's not what's happening here. Instead, we learn from the letter in Smyrna that those of the synagogue of Satan were people claiming to be Jews, claiming to be acting as descendants of Abraham, but really were not. In fact, in Smyrna, what they were doing was slandering the Christians. Now, commandment number 9 says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And yet here these ones were purporting to be God's chosen people, making a show of slandering Christians just to get them in trouble. It seems a similar thing was happening in Philadelphia as well. People who are claiming to be Jews but really are not, those are who are called the synagogue of Satan. And Jesus says, I'm going to take steps to make sure that you are acknowledged to be the ones that I indeed love. Contrary to whatever they might have to say about you, let me encourage you with this. Remain and continue on being faithful despite that. And then Jesus goes on to tell them this. Because you have kept my word of patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. Because you have remained faithful, I will exempt you from this hour of trial. I've been talking about the letter to Smyrna a fair bit because there are many parallels. To the church in Smyrna and to the church in Philadelphia, Jesus has no words of correction to give. Both of them are dealing with this synagogue of Satan. Both of them are dealing with challenges. Smyrna was a very impoverished church. We learn that Philadelphia was weak comparatively in strength. And yet it's interesting that Jesus addresses them differently. To Smyrna, he says, I see your works. I see that you're going through these great trials and difficulties. It's going to get worse. Remain solid and faithful. Endure even to death. To Philadelphia, he says, I see that you have been faithful and working through challenges. I'm going to exempt you from the trial that is about to come. Why is it that Jesus sees fit to let Smyrna deal with an increase in persecution and yet promise to remove Philadelphia from an upcoming trial. Now, it certainly seems there are two different categories of thing going on here. In Smyrna, the persecution to come is clearly being done by someone else, something outside of them. Whereas this hour of trial that is coming to test all the inhabitants of the earth sounds like something that God indeed is going to be bringing about. And so I think we are dealing with two different categories of thing here. But let's lay that aside for now and simply acknowledge that Jesus is speaking to two churches that both show similar faithfulness, and yet one of them is told, life is going to get tough and I'm not going to do anything about it. And to the other one, he says, you've been enduring and I am going to exempt you from what is to come. What do we do with that image of Jesus? Do we see that as something that is incongruous with what we believe to be true about Jesus or what we like to believe about Jesus? Do we see this as being something that is incompatible with who Jesus is? Or does our discomfort with this scenario speak more to what we are assuming rather than what actually is? You see, here's the thing. We tend to have this idea that if you have two churches doing the same kind of thing, that God ought to treat them equally, that Jesus ought to make the same promise to both. After all, isn't that only fair? And if that's what we camp on, then we're going to have a tremendous struggle. But is that really what it's all about? I mean, you've heard me say in the weeks and months before that we always need to consider what we read in the Bible and what we conclude about it in light of God's character, in light of the character of Christ. We need to keep those things in mind and understand what is God up to, what is Jesus up to. And so when it says in the Bible that God does not show favoritism and he's no respecter of persons and those kinds of things, it kind of seems like God's favoring Philadelphia over Smyrna. But is that actually what's happening? The only reason we would conclude such things is if we are convinced that both churches ought to be treated exactly the same. But they're in two different cities, two different contexts, two different scenarios. And if we allow ourselves to conclude that Jesus likes Philadelphia better than Smyrna, or something like that, we're missing something very important, especially when we consider our life as the Church of Jesus Christ around the world today. Because the church in North America is blessed. We don't have to be afraid of going to church. We are affluent in comparison to the rest of the world. I mean, in North America, this is the only place in the world where you can be considered below the poverty line and still own a car. And we as Christians in North America have it quite well, thank you very much. We have the luxury of choice. We have all sorts of things coming to us, and we can worship freely. Whereas you compare other churches in the world, and for them, we find that oftentimes they have to be underground for fear of actually giving up their lives or being imprisoned and even tortured for their faith. Does that mean God favors the church in North America over the church elsewhere in the world? Does that mean that favoritism is taking place, that Jesus is somehow doing something inappropriate? Are we suggesting then that we ought to insist that Jesus treat us just like the other churches? That we should have the persecution everybody else shares? After all, that just makes it fair, right? Why don't we think of it that way? We tend to think, no, it should be the other way. All the churches should be just as blessed as us. But what is it that we deal with in North America? We deal with something that Ephesus had to be addressed. Had to have addressed in it. The complacency that can come. The idea that because we can just go to the grocery store and buy the bread that came from the grain that we planted in the spring and is now providing food for us, it's so easy for us to get food. We don't need God. We don't need to trust God. We don't need to plead and say, Lord, please provide, because we can just go to the grocery store. And for us, we can find that our faithfulness to God might well be challenged more than the faithfulness to God to a church that's facing life or death reality. Because for us, complacency is not far away. Jesus deals with each church according to each church's context. And we hate it that we don't know what exactly is going on in Jesus' mind with every situation he deals with. I know that's the case because that's how we feel about medical technology, right? If something's wrong with us and we've got this weird thing going on, we go to the doctor. And if the doctor says, yeah, I have no idea what's going on, we're never satisfied with that. Well, we're going to get the second or third or fourth opinion. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do, but we cannot tolerate the idea that we don't know something. And yet we don't know everything. And we certainly don't know everything about the mind of God. We don't know everything about the mind of Christ, but what we can know, what has been communicated in spades over and over again, whether we think of Jesus as the Good Shepherd or whether we think of Jesus as the returning King, is the promise that I will be with you, that I am walking among the golden lampstands, that I hold the heart of the church in my hand. You will not be removed from me. And so whether a person's living in Smyrna and having to endure persecution yet to come, or whether a person is living in Philadelphia, where the promise is that there will be an exemption to the challenges that are coming, the call remains the same: to acknowledge the Holy One, to acknowledge the True One, to remain faithful to the One who is the author of life, and to continue to open our hearts to the One upon whom we depend for all that we have, even in our affluence. Let everyone who has ears to hear listen to what Jesus is saying to the church. Amen.